thank you for joining us today for the Fair Losophy podcast. We're going to be talking about everything related to fair trade fashion, including sustainability, ethics, human trafficking, our artisans, and keeping kids in school. My name is Jackie Costello, and I own the Golden Rule Boutique, an all fair trade boutique based in San Diego. My co-host is Jen Parlin, and she is a fair trade partner with Threads Worldwide based in Connecticut.
In this episode, Jackie sits down with Brian Novak of ISOS Group. ISOS Group is working with companies to make them more sustainable. Brian shares about his past experiences working in the fashion industry in China. Enjoy.
Right. Hi, Brian. Thank you so much for joining us today. We met at Green Drinks a few weeks ago, and I was just hoping you could tell our listeners what Green Drinks is and then a little bit about yourself.
Great. Yeah. Thank you for having me. We did meet at Green Drinks. I was actually speaking there on behalf of my company, ISOS Group, on ESG investing and what ESG is, and I think we can dig into that a little bit later. But Green Drinks is great. It's a networking organization. They host events in a lot of different cities, so wherever you are, you should check out to see if there's a local Green Drinks. But they host monthly happy hours, and they'll have speakers come in and really talking about a variety of topics, but mostly around the environment and certain impacts, whether they be companies that are doing work to help conserve the environment, or maybe businesses such as yourself that are supplying goods that are environmentally and socially friendly. So it's a great event and a great organization.
Yeah, my friend Seth actually introduced me to it because in November you guys had a sustainability and fashion event. Yes. And it was so cool. I was so excited to see other things happening in fashion. You know, sometimes we feel a little isolated in our own business, like I'm the only one doing good things. So that was really cool. And then afterwards, I just, the event that I met you at was my second one, but I've been meeting so many amazing people. And we started composting since we met. Awesome. And met Alyssa from Food to Soil. So mm-hmm. There's just a lot of really cool people and a lot of things happening in San Diego, which is exciting.
Yeah, it's a really inspiring group of people, and you get a lot of energy. Kind of, I want to go back and do all these things. So it's awesome.
Yes, yeah. Totally. So can you tell me what ISOS Group is and when you started working there?
Yes. So ISOS Group is a sustainability consultancy. Mm-hmm. We help companies develop a strategy around sustainability and help them to then report out on the progress that's being made around that strategy. So if you go to a bigger company's website and you see their sustainability report, that's really what we're helping them work towards. But our services go beyond that. It's really three sort of buckets, the first being in training and education, and that's where we got our start a little over 10 years ago. The founder and CEO, she was working at an international bank, and they were looking for sustainable investments here in the U.S., and they were having a hard time finding organizations to go after, or who's doing what and who's doing what well, or the quote-unquote right way. So she decided to come back to the U.S. and sort of build the market through what's now called the GRI standards, the Global Reporting Initiative. And these are reporting standards for companies to talk about their progress on certain sustainability issues, both environmental, social, and governance issues. So she had brought the training here about 10, 15 years ago. We still hold the license. That's still a core part of what we do. We like to bring that education piece into our client engagements as well, and give them the tools to go off and do good work. So training is the first piece. The advisory is the second. And then the last is around assurance. So similar to financial statements that are audited, we can audit a company's greenhouse gas emissions or any other environmental or social metric. So that's something that we do as well.
Very cool. Yeah. So what type of companies are you working with? Are you working with just a broad range, anybody that wants their company to be more sustainable, since our listeners are, you know, focusing on fashion? Is that something that you guys do?
So we work with a wide variety of companies. I think the common factor is they tend to be bigger organizations. In the past 2 years, there's been a lot more investor pressure around being environmentally friendly or sustainable, or just understanding what your footprint even is. Mm-hmm. So those investors pressuring companies, and then those companies coming to organizations like us. If you go on, just as an example, if you look at a publicly traded company on Yahoo Finance, for example, for the top 2,000 companies, I think, or so, there's a sustainability tab and you can see how they're being scored. So it's just becoming more common knowledge how companies are performing, or how their perception of how they're performing is out there. So right now, circling all the way back, mostly publicly traded companies. We do have a lot of private companies that are interested, and you know, they tend to be doing it for some different reasons, really integrating it into their strategy, and it's a little bit more organic there. And then in terms of industries, we see a lot of real estate industry, because just the impacts of owning a huge portfolio of buildings and the impacts related to buildings. And then on the consumer goods side, we're seeing a little bit more traction there, at least for us, mm-hmm. as ISOS Group. But that's something that we see as a potential going forward, a potential area to focus.
Exciting. Very cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned at Green Drinks that you kind of had transitioned out of working in a job in Asia.
Yes.
And I'd love to hear more about that and kind of like this light bulb moment of not being able to work there anymore. So yes. Maybe specifically starting about, you know, what your job was and how long ago it was.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, so that's kind of what brought us here together too, is so at Green Drinks, I was mentioning that I spent 5 years working in China in fashion manufacturing. It was a family business, and how we operated was sort of an intermediary between U.S. brands and the manufacturers in Asia. I was based in China, Qingdao, China, and I held a variety of roles there, but when I first put my feet on the ground, it was really understanding, okay, how does all of this work? My background wasn't in manufacturing, it wasn't in fashion. You know, I'd studied business, I spent 2 years in finance and accounting. So it was how do things get made? What is our role in the supply chain? How do we interact with clients? How do we interact with the factories? So it was just a crash course on the job training, if you will. And that over time evolved. I took on some different projects that we did. I was always looking for new factories we could potentially be working with, trying to improve some of our internal processes around product development and quality. And then towards the end of my time there, the last 2 years or so, I was managing the office. We had about 50 people there, and we had about 100 to 150 million dollars worth of goods going through the office. You know, we weren't purchasing and selling. We were not the sort of Li and Fungs that are out there, but working on behalf of the client. I like to describe it as we were sort of like the client satellite office in China, their eyes and feet on the ground.
Okay. So what would you say your role in the supply chain was? I mean, you're the eyes and the, you know, the ears and those kinds of things, but mm-hmm. You mentioned the role in the supply chain. So how would you define that?
Yeah. So I would say we were like an expert third party, almost a mediator at times between the factories, the vendors, and the end customers. We had
So is that looking at pricing and are you getting to know how the workers are getting paid at all?
Got it. So we are, the focus for us was really around products. So I don't know if I had mentioned, but I said fashion manufacturing, our focus was really on fashion accessories.
Okay.
We were looking at jewelry, handbags, scarves, tech accessories, things like that. And what our role was really, I would say, focused around the product itself. So we were trying to help the factories understand through the different rounds of product development what the client was looking for and what they were trying to achieve, maybe suggesting options for different materials and how they could be used. And while always keeping an eye on the price, but the pricing decisions always came from the customer. We're 100% transparent in the work that we were doing between the clients and the factories. So
when you're saying customer, you actually mean the client of a company, right? Not necessarily like the consumer, right?
Correct. Okay. Yes. So a U.S., let's say a U.S. brand, we didn't work with them, but an example being like a Forever 21.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would, there are some companies that are out there that are in a similar space as we were that would just buy from the factories or hide factory names, hide the pricing, and then develop their own and give it to the client. We were more kind of an old school, maybe, player in the sense that we just let everyone interact. Like the client could talk with the factory directly if they wanted to.
Okay.
But our area was in that product development, ensuring in the production process that things were going smoothly, coming up with solutions if problems did happen. And a big piece of our value add was also in the quality area, because we had an inspection center there. We were doing almost 100% quality inspection on some of the goods that were coming through.
Okay. So were you yourself going through the factories or just looking at products offsite?
So I would go through the factories probably once a day.
Okay.
Yeah. So in seeing how things were going, you know, some of it is sort of just like client relations. Mm-hmm. You know, the factories weren't our clients, but making sure things are, understanding where they are coming from and, you know, what issues they may be having, and also looking at prospective new factories as well.
Okay. So what were you seeing inside the factories? Like working conditions? Did you know how they were getting paid? Those types of things.
Yeah. So it's a pretty wide variety in terms of what are out there in terms of factories. I would say one thing, particularly for jewelry factories, is there's a pretty significant difference between a jewelry factory and a garment factory.
Mm-hmm.
Garment factories, at least some that we've worked with for some of these brands, they could be putting out hundreds of millions of dollars of product. And a jewelry factory on the bigger end would maybe be $10 to $15 million in terms of the cost of the goods that they're producing and selling to their clients.
Mm-hmm.
So that being said, they typically were smaller buildings. They would be concentrated in areas where maybe the government, I was in China, so maybe the government designated that area for jewelry, or there were certain concessions that were made that prompted jewelry factories to go there. And inside, again, a pretty wide range where you can go in and there could be just three or four kind of long tables with people, workers just kind of doing the work by hand. All jewelry is really, or 90% of jewelry is handmade. So, you know, just assembling the pieces by hand. Other facilities were, multi-level, multi-building. But it would be sort of that same setup where you would have long tables with maybe 10, 20 people working, doing a specific process and then completing it, passing it off to the next table to do a different process.
Okay. And Did you ever feel uncomfortable walking into these places, the factories? Did it sadden you, or were you just like, oh, this is normal, this is, you know, this is safe, I don't have any problems with this?
I would say I definitely was desensitized over time. Going, and I actually, while you were asking that, I'm having a hard time thinking back to when I first stepped into a factory. There was, I probably have seen, I don't know, maybe 50 to 100 factories. And there was only once or twice where it felt, I can remember now at least having that feeling. And they were prospective, they were factories we were considering or just visiting for the first time. And
did you end up working with them?
We didn't end up working with them. One did have, I think a worker had their child there with them. And another, I think maybe just the condition inside the factory. You know, I was actually listening to a one of your earlier episodes coming in about the factories in LA. And then I think someone also had brought up Rana Plaza. And so that's one thing I want to sort of differentiate too with the jewelry factories, is you didn't necessarily see these big buildings or multi-tenant buildings. So not necessarily like a building in poor shape, but just how was the interior, how was maintained, you know, just kind of messy and not well kept.
So different what our typical working environment would be, right?
Yes,
here.
Absolutely.
So maybe you can talk about your journey and how you decided, or why you decided not to work there anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was a combination of things which had me leave, or which I chose to leave. But one of the pieces was just understanding the social and environmental impact of the goods that we were helping to produce. I would say I sort of had an eye for just being environmentally conscious growing up. Love being outside, love the outdoors. I had a friend I grew up with. I don't think I've ever told him this, but he would make fun of me for like not recycling, and then I would make fun of him for being so crazy about like recycling. And, but one day I was just like, wait, I'm the one that's wrong here. So, and that sort of just like opened to like, well, I should consider more about the things that I do on a regular basis. So, that kind of snowballed. And while I was in China, I started thinking about that a little bit more and took some online, those like massive free online courses. Understanding a little bit more about sustainability, what sustainability means, what cities are doing, what companies are doing, and just to just get a better understanding of what that means. And that sort of exposure and learning and hearing more about it really made me want to focus more on helping businesses become more sustainable. And I didn't feel like in our position, being sort of that intermediary trying to please both parties, the US brands and the foreign manufacturers, that we had enough leverage to say, well, let's consider these things. It would really need to come from the brand itself that was interested in whether it be a line of their product to be more environmentally friendly, or their entire portfolio. So,
sorry, do you mind me interrupting?
Yes, please.
Just real quick, did the U.S. brands ever care? Did they ever ask how the factory workers were being treated? If there were ever, you know, safety questions or any, how were they being paid, and any of that?
Right. So the social, yes. So the social piece is, there were annual audits conducted by another third party, but on behalf of the clients or the brands, And they would come in, they would look at everything from the safe working conditions, maybe fire hazards, making sure all the fire extinguishers were charged and could be used. They would go through the payroll, they would look at the books, they would do interviews with workers to understand, just to hear from them. But those happened once a year, and typically there were some minor findings. Maybe the exit sign wasn't lit up, or this fire extinguisher wasn't charged. Maybe some discrepancies in the payroll that they saw, but those were all really considered minor findings. Mm-hmm. And then we would work with the factory to correct those findings that were found, and submit evidence, and then that would be really the audit process. There's typically a compliance person working at each of the brands that's guiding that process, but it was more around just making sure that each of the factories is getting audited, and those corrective action plans are coming in, than really trying to maybe address some root cause problems or trying to create some, I would say, change, or right. whether it be cultural change or just change within those factories.
Right. It's more like, let's just make sure we're compliant and we can get through this audit, instead of how are these people being treated and are they getting a livable wage?
Yes.
You know, they're just like, let's get through it.
Right. Yeah. It's more of a check. I would say it's almost a check the box to make sure that we're, as a brand, protected. And yeah.
And that's kind of how I've noticed, because people just kind of turn a blind eye to it. Mm. You know, I'm in a mastermind, and I was going to a workshop with the mastermind, and I met this gentleman who works in factories in China. Mm. And I introduced myself, tell him what I do, and you know, he didn't seem to think anything of it, but I pulled him aside after, instead of like asking him in front of the group about, you know, working conditions and things like that. And he was like, he was almost offended, you know. He was like, I have no say. I have, you know, it's not me, you know, so why should I do anything about it? And he almost felt like I was attacking. I was like, I'm honestly just asking because I'm curious what it looks like and how it works. And he was like, they just want to work more. They want to work more overtime, you know. And it's like, they want to work more overtime because they can't be paid a livable wage, you know, so they have to work overtime to survive. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like this vicious cycle. And so I just think it's really interesting that we're desensitized and we just automatically do a blind eye to it, you know?
Right. And I think that's absolutely right. And I think that's one of the maybe arguments or narratives that you hear is, because I heard it myself several times when I was there, is that most of the workers in the factories, they're not from the places they're working. So they want to earn money. They want to earn as much money as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. And then they're sending a good chunk of that back home to their families.
Yep.
So that same story where, they want to work overtime. They want to work as much as possible to earn as much as possible. But that, to your point, you know, if you did look at having those livable wages, would that, you know, reduce the need for that? And I mentioned a little bit before where I'm still on the fence of what's right and what's wrong. And, you know, on the other side, there is the business aspect of it for the factories, where, you know, if you did, you're reducing the output and increasing the cost and how to account for that. And that's why it's such a complex problem, because then you say, well, who has the power to control that? And maybe that's the brand, and how much that they're paying the factories for the products that they're buying. If, you know, if the price increases, then the factories have a little bit more leeway. But that's not to say the owner doesn't just pocket the difference.
Right. And they're almost, exactly, the owner. Yeah. And they're almost blaming each other, right?
Yes.
Because the factory has to keep prices low so that they'll get chosen, right, out of these other factories. And it's a big competition. U.S. brand could just go to another factory while they're charging less for the same product. Mm-hmm. And then U.S. brand is like, well, you know, we have to keep our prices low. So everybody's just focusing on that and not really thinking about the people, you know. So it's like this crazy world. And I totally understand as a business owner myself, you know, a big chunk of my profits was going to my employees.
Right.
And I had to pay them not a lot of money, you know. It's you know, minimum wage and that kinds of things. But employee costs eats a lot of your profits, right. You know. So it makes sense. It's like, how do we make it better? And how do we, you know, make it better for everyone, you know?
Yeah, it has to be a collaborative process. And I think that's sort of more and more being realized, that brands can't just necessarily tell factories, this is how you run your business. At the same way a factory can't tell a brand, this is how you should run your business. That need to be in the same room, probably behind closed doors, and with an organization that really understands or has a good understanding of the complexity. I think it's hard to be able to capture all those things, but there's a lot of good work being done, I think, with like companies like Business for Social Responsibility, BSR. They're up in San Francisco, and that's more on the social side. I think there's also like the Higg Index on the more environmental side, environmental cost of some of the materials going into garments.
Oh, I actually never heard of that before. You know, things that we talk about are like B Corps and, you know, but I've never heard of, could you say it again?
So, and by the way, ISOS Group is a B Corp. We're a benefit corporation as well here in California, and a woman owned small business. So we hit, you know, several of those.
Which is awesome. Yeah.
Which we're proud about. And BSR, which is Business for Social Responsibility. I believe they're a nonprofit, but they're based up in San Francisco, and they do a lot of work in supply chains and mostly around social impacts.
Cool. And they kind of do what B Corp is doing, like they're a third party entity that is giving, you know, a certification like a B Corp, or is it just something totally different that they're working alongside businesses?
Yeah, they're working more on the latter, working alongside businesses, trying to, they have a couple different initiatives, I believe. I actually haven't looked recently, but to engage both the supply side and the buy side to work on some of those things. But I would definitely recommend that, to check that out.
Very cool. And the other one was...
And then, so the other is the Higg Index, which is H-I-G-G, Higg Index. And we were, when I was in China, I was looking at how we may be able to apply that to what we do. And that's more, I believe, at the time was around the environmental impacts of garments. And just based on the materials that are being used, maybe the production processes, you can have some sort of score associated with that piece of clothing.
So were you finding that people in your company were interested in something like that, or were they just like, no, we don't need to do that?
This was me, myself, and I. Yeah. I found out about it on my just kind of doing some research, and then started digging into it. And of course that idea just like kind of blew up in my mind, but just knowing the landscape that's there, and also was more catered toward the apparel side. Mm-hmm. It didn't go anywhere, but that company still exists, that organization that manages the Higg Index. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the thought in my head at the time was, it would be amazing if one day, you know, you look at the washing instructions on the label of your clothing, and then there's also an environmental impact score, yes, like a social impact score. That would be really cool.
Yeah, totally. And there are a couple, not memes, but like graphics coming up now of things like that. Your shirt had three slaves involved in it, like something like that. But then also like these other ones of, you know, this prevented this amount of water from being wasted, you know, things like that. So, we work with a brand called Tonelay, and they, are a zero waste fashion brand. So they, are reusing garments from another factory that would have ended up in a landfill. So they're typically smaller runs, really, really cool products. I love everything that they have, but, that I wonder if that is, I don't think it's on their tags, but they do. Oh, I'm sorry. It is on their tags. And it'll say, you know, this is prevented, you know, this amount of water from being wasted. And then it goes into more detail on their website, which is really cool. Awesome. So yeah, we work with a couple cool brands like that, but, it is interesting hearing about these other things that like the Higg Index and things like that I've never really heard about before, you know, even being in this space for quite some time already. Going back to the workers and how they were treated, I kind of skipped over this question by accident. I was wondering if you had any employees that you directly talked with, and, you know, if they ever said anything to you about how they were treated or their wages or anything like that.
Yeah, so I can speak some Chinese, but not very well. Mm-hmm. So I never really had much interaction, like in terms of having a conversation about the conditions and things like that.
That's probably a good point. That's another thing that's happening. There's this language barrier, right? Mm-hmm. That even if somebody wanted to talk or, you know, say something or, you know, question you about something, you know, then they wouldn't really be able to do that, and you vice versa, you know?
Exactly. And we did have a few people on our team, on our staff, that were focused on compliance as well. But it, quite honestly, it was a similar function to the brand's function to ensure that, because we had a network of factories that they were in compliance, and we would go through and conduct sort of our own audits to make sure that things were prepared for when those third party audits happened. The people on that team had some more insight, and I was able to talk with them some and understand a little bit more. One of the difficult things about the supply or just the manufacturing landscape as well is the use of subcontractors. And so, sorry, I'm just kind of like going off on a tangent here. I'm not trying to avoid the question, but it's sort of like some of the context that helps is, so we have factories that we'll work with, and then maybe a beautiful building, really clean, really organized. Those are the factories that brands will go and see and visit and say, oh, we want to work in this factory. And then that factory probably has 5 to 10 core subcontractors that it's using to do certain processes. Just as any other company, you know, it's, as you grow, it's easier to have someone else do the bookkeeping and someone else do, you know, different parts of the business. So that happens. And then sometimes those subcontractors have subcontractors of their own. So it's just this really complex web that it's hard to get down to some of those levels. We were able to see some of that second tier, those subcontractors, maybe if they were a key subcontractor or key supplier to the factory we worked with, but it really stopped there. So all that being said, when we did conduct audits with those first tier factories, they're really, you know, the conditions for the most part in terms of the working environment were given it being in China, I would say, and being in a jewelry factory, to me, nothing, the factories we worked with, I didn't see any significant issue. And then there were some questions though around the pay side. I've heard that factories sometimes will have two sets of books talking that show the payroll, and show the workers who were there. And that's something that I'm not sure if some of those auditors that do go in have a full understanding about. Right. And I mean, I certainly don't, but just knowing that there are two sets of books and kind of what to look for, I mean, that just shows that there's so much opportunity for something bad to happen.
Right. There. And they're hiding things probably. Right. And, you know, that's when things like, you know, labor trafficking can come about. Mm-hmm. You know, they can just easily hide what's going on and, you know, hide people. And it's like another reason why it's so hard to really know what's going on.
Right.
Because how can anyone know when mm-hmm. when there's deceit and, right. you know, and even just tracking all of the workers, it's like, well, they could have this extra person that they just don't even know, you know?
Right.
I know. I'm saying, you know, a lot, Jen, and laugh at me, but
but to your point, and it kind of goes to what we were talking about earlier, then, you know, these audits, they're really not accomplishing what maybe they first set out to do,
mm-hmm.
where factories are afraid of having a finding, so they're doing whatever they can to conceal whatever they think is wrong, and then the auditors aren't finding it, and then the factory, the brand continues giving them work.
Mm-hmm.
I could.
Wouldn't it be amazing if, instead of all that deceit, we're using that to figure out how to a solution to the problem?
Right.
You know, just be a different world.
Yes.
You know? So I'd love to get really down into what was that moment that you were like, I can't do this anymore. And like, I know you talked a little bit about watching these sustainability videos and like realizing you couldn't do that. But was it because you just wanted to do better work somewhere else, or what was it?
It was, I mean, there were some personal pieces to it. Just my I hate saying this because the topic we're talking about, but my quality of life, I mean, just being in a foreign country, especially not being able to speak the language mm-hmm. for that period of time. And I know
how long were you working there?
5 years. And I know people are in much harder situations, but I had an opportunity to go and then I had an opportunity to leave. So I went down that path. So one was the personal side. Another being the work, that a little sense of powerlessness, not just in being able to try to create change,
mm-hmm.
but also just in the core work that we did.
Yeah.
Even if we tried to explain to a factory that, you know, the client needs this certain material made this certain way because of XYZ, in the end, they make the product so they could just say yes or no. And then the same thing on the client side. Well, you have to understand the factory needs to source this material special from here, so the cost needs to go up X cents. And in the end, they place the order, so they say yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it was the sort of vision I had for what we could do as that intermediary. I didn't see it as attainable. And then also for some of the work that we did, it's just it's a tough place to be in. It's a thankless job in the sense that when something goes wrong, we're the first person that's getting called and blamed. And then the 95% of the time where everything's going fine, like, you know, you don't hear our name. You don't know we're doing anything.
Yep.
But that just means we're doing our job. So it was tough for that environment as well. And I guess I then thought, you know, what work could, how could I do that change that I wanted to? And so I felt like at least coming back to the U.S. was the first step.
Mm-hmm.
I wish there was, I can't say there was an exact moment, or if there was, it got lost because my transition out of my role and back into the U.S. took about a year. And that was talking about environmental impact, flying back and forth between China and New York and maybe once a month and being in each place about, you know, half a month. And so that was a pretty grueling process, but wanted to make sure that things, you know, we still have clients that needed work to be done. We still had an office that still exists that you know, that we I wanted to ensure that they were taken care of too. So, and while also trying to look and plot out what my plan of attack was going to be.
Mm-hmm. And since then, since you transitioned out of that role, have you thought that your shopping habits have changed in any way since you've seen a lot of the supply chains?
Yeah, I would say the biggest change would probably be I never bought a lot of stuff, but buying less.
Mm-hmm.
And then I need to tell people to stop giving me t-shirts because like I just accumulate t-shirts. I'm like, I haven't bought half of these t-shirts and I'd have like a stack of them. So I would say buying habits, probably buying less would be first, and then really going after quality.
Mm-hmm.
Which means more expensive. But if you're buying less, you know, the argument sort of is if you're buying less, you have more money to spend when you do spend it, and then you can buy maybe higher quality that will last longer.
Definitely. Quality over quantity. Yeah. I love
so
that.
These, I actually bought these jeans from a really cool shop, not too far from where we are right now. Unfortunately, they closed, but the company, I think the jean company is like Rogue Territory. It was the most expensive piece of clothing I think I've ever bought. These were, and you know, there's all that stuff on like how to wash your clothes and wash your jeans. These, if we talked a month ago, these probably would have been like 6 to 8 months not being washed, but they're relatively clean right now.
Well, that's good. Thank you. Yeah. Since we are in a car right now, thank you for that.
Yeah, of course. And, but I mean, it's certain things like that. And I know, and it's tough though, too, because the less, if you buy less, you have less to wear, you maybe need to wash it more often. And now, you know, the damage between what detergents can do and the washing machines can do, the struggle is real.
The struggle is real. And even just the fact that you brought up washing machines, mm-hmm. you know, we have talked about these filters that go on washing machines because the little plastic fibers that come out of clothing, and we don't have one, but one day I'd like to have one just because those little plastic fibers are in everything that we wear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if it's, you know, a recycled material, you don't necessarily know what fabric that is. And, you know, it's great that we're recycling materials and using other fabrics, but then we don't know what's in it. And all of those little fibers are ending up in our oceans. So that's just another broad topic, you know, yes. that, and there's so much, like you just said, the struggle is real. There's so much we could dive into.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I could, you know, we could right. sit here and talk exactly. about it forever, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just all so tightly related, you know? Mm-hmm. So first off, thank you so much for joining me in the car today.
Yeah,
I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. This is awesome.
And I love what your company's doing. So if anybody's interested, how could they find out more about your company and you?
Yeah, so you can jump on our website. I feel like a presidential candidate. You can check us out online. So it's isosgroup.com, isosgroup.com. And we have kind of the services that we offer. A lot of it in the advisory and assurance space is again, typically we see clients that reach out to us are some of those larger publicly traded companies. If you're interested in, trying to work for one of those companies that is in, you know, trying to build their sustainability practice, or just want to understand more about the reporting standards that are out there. We offer trainings about once a month on some of the different reporting platforms and mechanisms that are out there. We just are bringing the training online this year, so that's something cool. You don't have to fly to wherever we're hosting to jump on. So
awesome.
Would encourage you to check that out. And I also, we have a small team, so I'm also on managing the, I maybe shouldn't say this out loud, but managing the like info@isosgroup.com email. So if you write us a message on the contact us form, I'll probably be the one responding. But you can also reach out to me directly if you'd like.
Yeah.
B for Brian. So B Novek at isosgroup.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much. This was such a great interview and I'm so excited for listeners to hear it.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Here at the Fairlosophy Podcast, we recognize that we do not live in a bubble. We are all connected. There are people behind every product we shop for, and we can influence their lives when we vote with our dollar. If you like this episode, take a screenshot and share it on your social media. When you do, you'll be entered to win a giveaway that we will do live on Instagram once a month. Tag us and follow us at the Fairlosophy Podcast. Good luck.